This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the wildfire in Maui was the deadliest in the U.S. in over a century. We'll find out how climate change and development patterns can put more people at risk. Now, a grand jury in Georgia filed criminal charges against former President Donald Trump and others in Georgia earlier this week. Here's Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis making that announcement.
A Fulton County grand jury returned a true bill of indictment, charging 19 individuals with violations of Georgia law arising from a criminal conspiracy to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in this state.
This is the fourth criminal indictment brought against the former president this year. We're taking a look now at this latest round of indictments, how they fit into the broader legal landscape of charges brought against the former president, and updates from on the ground in Georgia. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions, what thoughts do you have about the most recent indictment of the former president? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll start in Georgia with Sam Gringlass, a reporter for WABE News in Atlanta, where he's been covering the Fulton County probe of the 2020 election. Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've been watching this Fulton County probe evolve over the last, two and a half years. Can you remind us how it got started there in Georgia?
So this investigation really began not long after this infamous phone call in the weeks after the 2020 election. This was between Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, and then President Trump. Trump asked the Secretary of State to find him votes, the number of votes he would have needed to win Georgia, even though Joe Biden had already been declared the winner. A new district attorney in Fulton County had just taken office around that same time. And it wasn't long before she began this investigation in earnest to figure out if crimes had been committed in these efforts to subvert the election result in Georgia.
I know the prospect of indicting former President Trump, it's been contentious around the country. What has the chatter been in Georgia leading up to and now after these indictments were released?
Well, I think in the beginning, people were still really needing to digest. These indictments came late in the evening on Monday, so many people woke up to the news. I would say many Democrats see these charges as the first steps toward accountability for people who they see as having tried to chip away at their voting rights. And then within the Republican Party, it is more of a mixed bag. You have figures like Georgia's Secretary of State Raffensperger, who I just mentioned, who had a statement saying that the most basic principles of a strong democracy are accountability and respect for the Constitution. But then you have, the state party, Republican Party apparatus, who is calling this investigation partisan, channeling much the same language that we have heard from former President Trump and calling it a partisan witch hunt.
What happens next, Sam? You've got former President Trump, 18 other people charged here, and they have to show up, I think, at a local jail to report in?
So the district attorney has told the defendants that they have until next Friday at noon to voluntarily surrender. They will be booked at the Fulton County Jail. And we've just learned this afternoon that the district attorney is requesting arraignments to begin the week of September 5th, heading toward a proposed trial date on March 5th of next year. So all of this is moving rather quickly after this long investigation, though I expect there to be many factors that slow this process down as we really get into it over the next couple of weeks and months.
And before I let you go, Sam, the district attorney, Fani Willis, had hinted that, you know, there might be some sort of turmoil, protests, whatever might happen. Has there been any sign of that, at least so far, since this announcement late Monday?
You're right. The district attorney told law enforcement to prepare for a significant public response. She has talked about many of the threats that she's received, many of them racist. The law enforcement have said they've investigated many of them. But in the end, it was fairly quiet outside the courthouse this week, apart from the many TV trucks and throngs of reporters and police officers who were lined up. No real protests in downtown Atlanta as this decision has unfurled. But of course, there'll be plenty more opportunity. We have arraignments and booking and many more steps ahead in what's going to be a very long process.
Sam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Sam Greenglass, reporter for WABE News in Atlanta, where he's been covering the Fulton County probe of the 2020 election. Now, how do these charges fit into the growing list of indictments against former President Trump? Cheryl Bader is a clinical associate professor of law at Fordham University Law School and a former assistant U.S. attorney in the District of New Jersey. Cheryl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's nice to be with you.
Now, this is the second set of indictments related to former President Trump's action in attempting to reverse the outcome of the 2020 election. How do you see what we saw in this indictment comparing to the federal indictment on these issues?
So there are a lot of similarities. They cover a lot of the same ground. But Smith took a very narrow focus. I think strategically he wanted to streamline the case. He only charged Donald Trump, even though there were other, you know, unnamed co-conspirators there. So that's a, you know, one big difference. Another difference is that, he went in a more cautious approach as to what he charged. For instance, he didn't even charge inciting an insurrection, which is something that many people were expecting. Whereas the indictment here, Willis has actually done a very expansive indictment, as was mentioned, 19 people, and also charged pretty aggressively, including the state's RICO statute, which gives her many advantages in terms of evidence that she can bring in.
I want to give a listen to District Attorney Fannie Willis in Georgia talking about that, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization, or RICO. Here's a listen.
Every individual charged in the indictment is charged with one count of violating Georgia's Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act through participation in a criminal enterprise in Fulton County, Georgia, and elsewhere to accomplish the illegal goal of allowing Donald J. Trump to seize the presidential term of office beginning on January 20th, 21.
Let's talk about that RICO concept, Cheryl. Different states have different statutes. Georgia's is a little more expansive, I understand it. But in general, what does it mean when prosecutors and grand juries are pursuing indictments under RICO laws?
So think of RICO as an umbrella crime, where there's one overarching scheme. Here it is to overturn the election. And what is called racketeering activity that's done in furtherance of that, you know, common corrupt goal. And so, you know, you bring in different levels of players into this one sort of nefarious enterprise that's charged. And originally, RICO was enacted to prosecute mob bosses who would be able to evade prosecution because although they ran the operation, they didn't get their hands dirty by committing the actual crimes. And so here we see, you know, many layers of, you know, the sort of, you know, top players, Trump and those in his inner circle, you know, working their way down to people who were just brought in for, you know, particular aspects of, you know, these conspiracies. And, you know, in general, you know, there's a lot of similarities between, you know, federal RICO or other state RICO statutes. You know, as I said, both bring in various criminal acts into sort of the one overarching scheme. But Georgia has a slightly broader approach in that it doesn't require quite as much continuity of the enterprise as some other states. It has a broader array of criminal activity that qualifies as racketeering conduct. For instance, here, lying to government officials, also soliciting a crime, right? That's sufficient. And courts in Georgia have interpreted it, you know, liberally in terms of what evidence gets to come in. And that's usually the big advantage of RICO, is it allows a prosecutor to bring in evidence that they may not otherwise be able to get in. And in Georgia, for instance, they can actually bring in evidence that happened in other states. And you see that in the indictment, references to activity that happened in other states or in other counties like, you know, Coffee County. And so, you know, that's a big advantage. And this prosecutor particularly likes and has used RICO effectively in the past.
And reading the indictment, again and again, there are outlines of activity. This is under the RICO charges now, where an individual act might be legal. A tweet from the then President Trump or a call to a government official. Those acts might not in and of themselves be illegal, but they're, it seems like, building a pattern of this wider goal, as you say, with the intent of overturning the election result. Can you talk about that kind of drumbeat of all these different activities that get painted through in the indictment?
Right. So some people might look at this and say, you know, why is it a crime to schedule a meeting, you know, in an official, you know, government building? That's not a crime, right? But that's one of the allegations that the, you know, for in order to facilitate the false electors, you know, being able to meet and, you know, indicate falsely that they were the true electors. So we see that, you know, there's much activity about tweeting, et cetera, but it's to give context, you know, for the entire scheme. And so when, you know, when jurors are listening, they're not just looking at something in a silo, right? They understand how the pieces of the puzzle fit together and have a greater context, which is very important for a prosecutor telling a narrative.
We're talking to Cheryl Bader from Fordham University's School of Law, looking at the latest charges brought against former President Donald Trump and 18 alleged co-conspirators by a grand jury in Fulton County, Georgia, earlier this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on this latest indictment? Do you have questions about it, about how this will work in practice? Do you think this might have an impact on Trump's campaign for president? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Cheryl Bader from the Fordham University School of Law, looking at the fourth and most recent criminal indictment against former President Donald Trump relating to attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election outcome in the state of Georgia. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Join in with your reaction to this latest round of indictments against President Trump and 18 others. If you have questions for our guest about the various indictments against the former president, how they'll play out potentially in courts, you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Aaron is with us in Oshkosh. Aaron, hi.
Yes, hello and good day, everybody. Thank you for taking the call. I was probably one of the last generations to actually go through a civics class in Madison, Wisconsin, back when they still did those things in high school. Now, it's been a while since I checked, and I believe that there are still requirements having to do with a person's character and not having criminal charges and these other restrictions that you had to do to, one, meet the bill to be able to run for either a public office, but especially the presidency. And with multiple felony charges against him in multiple districts across the country, both state, local, and federal, how is he even allowed to qualify to be able to run for the candidacy?
Aaron, thanks for the call. One important clarification, indictments and charges, but not convictions in any of these cases yet. And in constitutional law, Cheryl, you have to be a certain age. You have to meet citizenship requirements, and that's about it. So those kind of requirements aren't out there, as I understand it.
That's exactly right. One would think that we'd be learning in a civics class that you do have to have a certain character, but in fact, the Constitution doesn't speak to that. And so, you know, he could continue to hold office. There is sort of a little bit of an exception in the 14th Amendment that talks about when someone takes an oath to uphold the Constitution and they engage in insurrection, then they can't hold office. And so, you know, to the extent that in the, you know, DC case, to the extent that there's evidence around, you know, inciting the insurrection, could, even if he's not, you know, convicted of those charges, could a hearing be brought, you know, through Congress? Possibly. Also, in the documents case, there would be issues if he is convicted about him having a security clearance in the future. And if, you know, because of the Espionage Act charges. And so, you know, that would certainly, you know, pose a problem, you know, for him if he's elected again. But, you know, again, we'll have to see how those things play out. But it's, you know, it's up to the people, and they have to sort of vote. And it amazes me that we're at a point where, again, he hasn't been convicted of anything. But I can't imagine a time when a candidate could have been indicted, you know, multiple times for these type of charges, and it wouldn't have been the death knell for the campaign. But here we see a very strong Donald Trump.
Aaron, thanks a lot for that call. Cheryl, on a practical level, I understand the district attorney in Georgia wants to try all 19 defendants in one trial. I'm no lawyer. That sounds difficult, cumbersome, and time-consuming. What are you watching for on a practical level of bringing this through the courts?
Absolutely. It's very ambitious, and especially on the timetable that she seems to want to do this, right? You have, you know, 19 defendants, they're going to have lawyers. Some of them may have more than one lawyer. You have all these schedules to deal with. You also have, you know, multiple motions. They also have to all be prepared, and some of them may be representing, you know, Donald Trump in other cases. And so I think it may be quite unwieldy. We may have less defendants actually going to trial because people do plead guilty. You might see people also cooperating, some of the defendants cooperating in the case, but it's been done, but it's quite a lift. And I don't think the time frame that she's laying out is I think it's overly optimistic.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Saul, hello.
Yeah, hi. Trump has a habit of throwing lawyers under the bus, and he's had trouble in the past of getting representation for that reason, either not paying them or betraying them. And I'm wondering whether that, and he's already making comments about how this grand scheme is really the idea of a bunch of lawyers. He wasn't involved. I'm wondering whether, A, does that hold among you know, in this kind of a prosecution, does that absolve him of guilt? And secondly, are they getting really hot testimony from some of the people that he's already indicated he's going to betray, I guess is the word.
Saul, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there. First of all, Cheryl, a possible defense Saul saying the president might make is, hey, my lawyers told me all this was fine, so I'm fine anyway. Maybe they're in trouble, but I'm not.
Right. So that may be his defense. I relied on the advice of my lawyer. But you know, that's fraught with certain problems. First of all, you know, you can't cherry pick and, you know, go through lawyer after lawyer. And remember, you know, the Justice Department, the intelligence community, right? Everyone is telling him, you know, that this is, you know, a fantasy, that there has been no, you know, fraud that would actually change the course of the election. And, you know, for him to go through and find that one outlier that's going to tell him, okay, we might, you know, find a way that this could work, I don't think is going to be a very viable defense. And also, as you said, like they're also going to be all sitting in the courtroom. And so, you know, sort of having the finger pointing both ways, you know, well, he's the one that told me to do it. Well, he's the one that did it, right? Is I think something that the prosecutor will, you know, will be happy to have that sort of crossfire back and forth.
Thanks a lot for that call. Saul at 800-642-1234. Cheryl, as this is going on, leading up to these indictments coming out, the former president had encouraged one person, a public official in Georgia, to not testify to the grand jury. He's been critical of judges, district attorneys and prosecutors in various cases. Could former President Trump be opening himself up to new charges, witness tampering, contempt of court, and others?
Yes, absolutely. We've seen, you know, his very destructive rhetoric. And that's, I think, the reason why there has to be so much security, right? Trump has become the master of, you know, parsing his words so that, you know, his various supporters and minions sort of know what he's saying. And there's been some really incendiary rhetoric around, you know, defaming, you know, prosecutors, judges, witnesses, law enforcement. And it's been very disturbing.
Now, looking at the various indictments working their way through the system now, Cheryl, I've seen some people make the case that, oh, these Georgia ones, these are the big deal. Others say, no, it's the Jack Smith January 6th ones. Which one do you watch more closely in the months to come? Which do you see as more significant, if either?
That's such a tough question because, you know, it's sort of like comparing is arson worse than murder? It's hard to compare the cases because there's so many, various factors. So as I said, in the documents case, I actually think that is the strongest case on the facts because they have, the smoking gun with, Trump showing these classified, very sensitive classified documents to people saying, oh, I know I could have declassified these previously, but I didn't. Telling, someone that they couldn't get close to a map because it was classified and sensitive, instructing his lawyer to say that we don't have any more documents and to sort of lose the ones that you found, surveillance tapes, et cetera. So, but it's complicated by the fact that, other people, including, sort of Biden, Pence, have, also had, documents in their possession. Of course, it's a very different situation because they turned them over very readily. They opened, their space and said, here, take whatever you have. It was a mistake. Whereas Trump really tried to hide these documents. But, I think that could be a potentially strong case, although, that's also going to be to probably the most conservative jury pool of the four cases. And so, the case in D.C., which is a lot like the case in Georgia that we're seeing now, I think that has, the potential to go before the election.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Cheryl Bader, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at Fordham University School of Law. We've been talking about the latest Trump indictment news, this one out of Georgia, and what we can expect to see as that case moves toward trial. It begins. My zucchini plants were a little slow to get rolling this year, but now they're starting to produce. I got a couple in the fridge right now, but wait, my sister-in-law had a very productive garden. I think she actually takes care of it or something. I don't know. And she was looking to unload some zucchinis. I accepted one big bag. She wanted us to take more. Yesterday's meal featured a side dish of zucchini, but I still have a lot left, including a couple of big ones. And we all know what that means. It means it's time to make some of the awesome zucchini relish recipe I found online a few years back. I'm sure I can make a few quarts with what I have. Still have plenty left for zucchini bread and probably some more side dishes. What is your favorite use for zucchini? Email ideas@WPR.org. I could probably use the help. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a Wisconsin expert on wildfires and development joins us for a look at the Maui wildfires, why they burn so quickly and cause so much devastation. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about self-love.
Feeling like you're different from your peers can have a big impact on your self-acceptance. But as Miriam Brabham of Green Bay tells us, a nurturing community helped her learn how to love her hair. She shares her story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
When I was young, I hated my hair. It spent most of its time tightly pulled into lopsided buns, surrounded by a halo of curly flyaways. In those early years, my curls were traumatized. They were dehydrated and unappreciated, and they were a visual reminder of what I didn't know and how I didn't fit in. As a multi-ethnic Black girl who was also a Messianic Jew, 9-year-old me saw my curls as yet another thing that othered me. At a North Chicago YMCA, I would watch the other girls after swim class with envy. Passing small combs through their wet, straight hair, they would sigh and huff as they started from the top of their heads and found resistance at the ends. These girls would finish detangling their whole head in 5 minutes. After swim class, I didn't have time to wash my thick hair. While the smell of Pantene and Suave filled the air, I used the water to help me gather my curls into an outstretched scrunchie. These rebellious curls, stinking of chlorine and a lack of information, would begin to clump together into impossible knots, almost as if they were so suffocated by the world that they coiled together for comfort. I hated my hair. It was time, effort, and a major contributor to my imposter syndrome collection. Not white enough, not Black enough, not Jewish enough, and yet too much. As I got older, the war with my hair became bitter. Temporary dyes, perms, and massive amounts of heat were met with split ends, chemical burns, and tension alopecia. Big chop after big chop left me at a shady hair braiding salon under the tracks on the north side of Chicago, where a woman used nail glue instead of hair glue and some overpriced box braids. Cutting out multiple braids, explaining why you shouldn't say good hair, and having monoracial people laugh at my ignorance left trauma residue all over my coils. The age of peace began when I started talking nice to my hair, instead of verbally berating it and subsequently myself. I learned so much about my hair while studying abroad in Botswana, Africa. The people were not shy or reserved in their comments and suggestions. They also didn't see me as separate from themselves. I just didn't know how to do my hair. The Botswana people taught me to love myself and my hair. I began to see my curls as an intrinsic part of myself. These curls can be playful springs that bounce in a sweet summer breeze. They can be strong, wide coils that keep the moisture to themselves and observe the world from scarves that set them on high. These curls can refuse to be tamed. They can go their own way, laughing at edge control and headbands alike. They can lay gently around my face. These curls define themselves and can easily change depending on the day and humidity. They have personality, and not shockingly, it's very similar to my own. So yes, there is trauma wrapped up in these curls. But like trauma in any of us, I am healing with love, time, and hair oil.
Miriam Brabham is a multicultural student success manager at UW Green Bay. And her story is part of the Home is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made up of 6 media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press Gazette. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the wildfires that tore across the Hawaiian island of Maui earlier this week were the country's deadliest in over a century. So far, over 100 people have been confirmed dead. That number is expected to increase as the remaining 2/3 of the burned area are searched. The town of Lahaina was hit particularly hard with over 2,000 buildings destroyed. It's not known what sparked the fires initially, but a lot of factors contributed to its intensity and spread, including dry conditions, fast-burning invasive grasses, and winds from Hurricane Dora. Our next guest has done research on the interaction between wildfires and the way we develop our buildings and communities around the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the Maui wildfire and the impact of wildfires in general? Do you worry about wildfires and other natural disasters getting worse, maybe, as the impacts of climate change continue to develop? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Volker Rodloff is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at UW-Madison, Volker, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned, you've studied the interaction between people and wildfires over the years. What stands out to you so far about what we know about the spread of these Maui wildfires?
The Maui wildfires were extreme. So the core of the destruction happened about in a two-hour period or so. And the high numbers, especially of life lost, and as you mentioned, over 100 confirmed already, and that number likely to increase. That is something we have not seen for a century or so. But the general condition of the combination of a fire starting in wildland areas, fueled by high winds, and then spreading into an urban area, suburban areas, and the houses become fuel, that's something we have seen increasingly in recent years.
Can you talk a little bit more about those conditions in Maui when this fire broke? Again, as you said, we don't know exactly what sparked it. It unfortunately was, it sounds like a perfect storm for the fast spread of this fire.
Absolutely so. And I think it's important to realize there were numerous fires already across all the Hawaiian Islands on the days before. So August 4th, the National Weather Service had given a warning of high wildfire risk due to the combination of dry condition and high winds from Dora. And on August 4th, there was already a 30-acre burn on Maui or so that was contained. On Tuesday the 8th, there was a fire on the eastern side of Maui at 12:22 a.m. that was called the Upcountry Fire. That ultimately burned about 1,000 acres, and a lot of the firefighters were working on that fire when then the Lahaina fire started at 6:37 a.m. That was initially a very small fire, only 3 acres, and by 10 a.m. it was reported that it was contained, that they had with dozers and so forth been able to control it or so. But then it flared up again in the afternoon at about 3:30. By 4:30, high winds, and then the embers, little burning pieces or so that the wind carried, had pushed all the way into the heart of Lahaina. By 4:45, an hour later, a lot of the exit roads were closed because of down power lines, because of cars that were burning and so forth, so people could not escape. And then by 5:45, the fire had reached the ocean front, and the Coast Guard is getting these horrifying messages of people in the water. So that's, in a nutshell, what happened in Lahaina, and it was incredibly fast due to these 80 miles per hour winds. And then as soon as the wildfire started, those embers were blowing into the settled areas, and then the houses themselves became fuel and created more embers that set more houses on fire.
Volker, I think of some types of ecosystems, like in the American West, maybe prairie places where there are quote-unquote natural wildfires, or ecosystems even rely on fire from time to time. As I understand it, in my very limited understanding, this is not true of Hawaii. This is not a place where we see, over the passage of time, regular wildfires. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, there is no natural wildfires, I mean, that this ecosystem would be adapted to. There may have been fires from volcanic eruption, from occasional lightning or so, but it was not a major part of that ecosystem prior to human habitation or so. So that is different from systems like chaparral in Southern California, or prairie savanna ecosystems in the Midwest, where fires were a much bigger part of the natural landscapes. And that is also important in the Hawaiian context, because the native plants are not adapted to fire. And when fires occur, they are lost. Those ecosystems are replaced by invasive species typically.
So this is a case where some level of human development and human change made wildfires more likely?
Absolutely, yes. And it's both a combination of the changes in the vegetation and the land cover, as well as then the ignitions that happened. And my understanding is also that what caused this fire exactly has not been determined. There's reports of down power lines, and such power line problems have caused many other wildfires before, but that investigation will take time. And given the amount of destruction and the insurance issues and all that, I'm sure people will be very careful to make exactly sure that they pinpoint the causes exactly. But human ignitions are causing most of the wildfires that lead to the loss of lives and structures. So they are a big factor.
Let's get to something looming here, climate change. Do the impacts of climate change make outbreaks of wildfires likely in more and more places, like in this case, unfortunately, Maui?
The quick answer is yes, and long drought periods certainly are a big concern. In these systems like Maui, where invasive grasses and shrubs are an important part of the fuel, we're also concerned, though, about the combination where we have one year with high precipitation, a wet year, which allows a lot of this herbaceous matter to grow. And if that's followed by a dry year, then we have conditions for very large fires or very intense fires or so. So yes, the climate change plays a role, and it plays a role in these drought conditions. And what that has caused across the US is that the fire season is much, much longer, where it used to be several months, and now wildfires occur 12 months of the year. And a few years ago, 21 in Boulder, we had the Marshall Fire in December or so. That was not fire season traditionally, and climate change is certainly a factor in that.
We're talking about the Maui wildfires and the interactions of people, development, and wildfires in general with Volker Radeloff, professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the wildfire in Hawaii or the trend of wildfires in recent years? Maybe an experience where you lived in a community that experienced one. Join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you just tried to call and didn't get an answer, I think we've got the bugs ironed out there. You could try again, 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Volker Radeloff, professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison, looking at the Maui wildfires, what caused them to be so fast and extreme, and wildfires, people, and climate change. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Kimberly is with us in Powell Lake. Kimberly, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Kimberly?
I just wanted to mention that if they were to trim the trees around their power wires like we do here, you know, 10 feet back, then they wouldn't have been entwined. And if they could have cut off the power to those, knowing that the storm was coming, they could have avoided that explosion of fire. And also, they didn't cut off the electric, but they did cut off the water. And I found that kind of strange.
Kimberly, thanks for the call. I didn't know about the water cutoff. I know fire hydrants had very low pressure, I've been hearing. But Volker, the idea that some management of power lines, including, as Kimberly says, keeping vegetation away, turning them off when there are dangerous conditions imminent, what do you think about that?
Those are definitely good suggestions. Thanks, Kimberly. Yes, so making sure that there are no trees that in a high wind condition can fall on top of the power line and break them and pull them down is highly beneficial. Having said that, that requires more than 10 or 15 feet clearing. That would require in many areas much wider cuts or so. And if at the bottom of the power line there are grasses or shrubs or so, if the power line comes down and is sparking, then fires would still occur. Cutting off power is in high wind condition is good, and it is something that is done in California and so forth, but it also comes at a high cost. That means that people in places where it is hot and dry right now no longer have air conditioning. That has medical consequences for many people. It means that people may not no longer have television and radio to listen to alerts and so forth. So I'm not sure what went into the decision in West Maui not to cut off the power, but it's not a solution that is easily done. As I mentioned, there were at least 4 days of high wind before, and cutting power off for a long period or so is difficult or troublesome. In hindsight, of course, yes, had the power been cut off at that point, and if the power lines were indeed the cause of this fire, things would have been much better, and that is true. I should also mention, in terms of the clearing of the power lines, this is becoming a very tricky issue now because a lot of the companies that have done that traditionally can no longer get insurance to do so, because the insurance companies are saying, if these clearings of the power lines were not done quite correctly enough and a fire occurs, then the insurance payments for that are just way too high or so. So in California, I know that electric companies are right now struggling to even find contractors to clear trees along the power lines.
Kimberly, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Volker, you've done research on human development, people building in areas that are prone to wildfires, the human-nature interface. What were some of the key things you found as you mapped these things out around the country?
Yeah, so those places are wonderful places to live in. I understand why people like to have their home there. These are places where the houses are close to wildland vegetation, to forests, to shrublands, to grasslands, some of which can burn. And across the U.S., about 30% of all housing units are in what we call the wildland-urban interface. That's the technical term. And we've worked on that issue with the Forest Service for the last 20 years or so, because it is a widespread problem. It makes wildfires a vexing problem. The issue is, first of all, human ignition. We talked about that a few minutes ago. In these places, fires are more likely to start because a barbecue grill topples over, power lines, and all of these issues are more concentrated there. And then when fires occur, it's not just firefighting that has to happen, but evacuations too, and protection of structures and so forth. And that complicates wildfire management greatly.
Let's go back to our callers with Jim in Newport Township, Illinois. Jim, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. You know, I've been to Hawaii several times. It's been a while. My first comment is about the Hawaiian culture, is that they don't get too really concentrated concern about much of anything there. But, you know, in order to have a fire, there has to be fuel. And even though the hard facts have not been assessed yet, I'm afraid there was just too much fuel in the form of dry vegetation so close to town, and then the perfect storm comes along, and you know the result. I mean,
Jim, so. I gotcha. Thanks for the call. And this is a common ingredient, Volker, I think, in a lot of quick spreading wildfires, that accumulation, as Jim says, of dried vegetation.
Absolutely. Yes. No, and that is when a drought comes together with high wind conditions. And then in the wildland-urban interface, by definition, we have these wildland fuels close to houses. That is not unique to Hawaii, though. We have these fuel conditions in large parts of California, the Intermountain West. We have it in parts of Wisconsin and the eastern U.S. as well. The Gatlinburg fires of 2016 were exactly the same pattern. I mentioned the Marshall Fire in Colorado and so forth. So that all is common. The invasive species are particularly widespread in Hawaii. About a quarter of Hawaii is covered by invasive species that are highly flammable. And in the past, there was more active agriculture, sugarcane plantation and so forth in Hawaii. That is no longer the case. Those former farm fields or agricultural fields are now covered by invasive species. So managing those fuels, Jim, I totally agree that is wise, that is necessary. That is not a trivial endeavor, though. Those are millions and millions of acres across the U.S., and how to manage them is not always clear. In case of these grassland, livestock grazing could maybe work, things like that, but prescribed burning, for instance, is not an option in those systems. It would just lead to even faster spread of these invasive species throughout the islands.
Thanks a lot for that call. Volker, I've had a couple of great conversations over the years with Stephen Pine, a fire expert who studied fire, its history all over the world. One thing I came away with is there isn't one solution that's going to work in this ecosystem and every ecosystem. The local fire characteristics may be very different from one place to another. Does that make it hard to come up with common solutions?
Very well put. Yes. Ecology is tricky because it's different in every place. And as you said, in Hawaii, we have too many fires and prescribed burning is not an option. In parts of the Sierras in California, we probably could use more prescribed burning. But in Southern California with chaparral, the fires are too frequent already. So the solutions have to be tailored to a given place and both to the native ecosystems as well as to the settlement patterns and so forth. But I think it has to be a combination of fuel management as well as thinking about evacuation, thinking about better ways of alerting people or so, and also to some extent the good old Smokey the Bear campaigns to stop ignitions to avoid in these highly risky situations fires from starting.
And Volker, just briefly, should more communities be doing more fire planning and make whatever that might look like in their community?
Absolutely. And I think community efforts are important. A lot of the vegetation management has to happen on private land or so. This is something that government agencies can help with, but communities and landowners have to step up. And they can do a lot. On average, in a given wildfire across the U.S., if a house is within the perimeter of that fire, it has only an 11% chance of burning. 89% of the houses survive. And a lot of that has to do with how the houses are built, how the vegetation is managed, and so forth. So there are things we can do. But yes, communities need to get together and take initiative.
Volker, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Volker Radulov is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. He talked to us about the Maui wildfires and human development in general. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, young people sued the state of Montana over climate-related laws and won in a ruling out this week. It's part of a wider effort by younger Americans who are likely to face the biggest impacts of climate change. We'll find out what that ruling means for the future. And there's growing evidence that our guts have a lot to do with our physical and mental well-being, but there are a lot of unanswered questions. We'll visit our gut microbiome and look at products sold with claims that they boost our gut health. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we learn about some of the untold stories of professional football's origins pre-1920, including a game-fixing scandal that nearly wrecked the professional game's future. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.